Well, it's called Starshines and Earthworks of the Desert Southwest by Gary David. It's about Hopi prophecy, you name it, and we're getting right into it in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. This has all the makings of one of those classic Coast to Coast shows. Gary David, archaeoastronomer, independent researcher for nearly 25 years, studied the archaeological ruins and rock art of the American Southwest. His nonfiction books explore Hopi mythology, star knowledge, rituals as well. And here he is on Coast to Coast AM. And we've got a lot of things that Gary sent us on our website at coasttocoastam.com. Hi, Gary. How are you?
Hi, George. It's great to be here.
Looking forward to this. Tell me a little bit more about yourself.
Yeah, I lived down here in Arizona for about 18 years, and I've been studying the Hopi culture and some surrounding Pueblo cultures. Before that time, I lived up in South Dakota and worked with the Lakota Sioux and taught on Pine Ridge Reservation and worked with the various factions around the Black Hills of South Dakota, which are sacred to the Lakota Sioux. So, you know, I've been involved with Native American studies most of my adult life.
What is archaeoastronomy?
Yes, I consider myself an archaeoastronomer. That's basically the way the ancient people conceptualized the heavens and the cultural effects that this science had on their lives. It was basically a naked eye astronomy, unlike our astronomy today. It didn't involve technology or empirical science. But, you know, it combined spirituality and mythology and a ceremonial practice along with watching the stars, a keen and persistent observation of the sky.
They, in those days, didn't have much to do. So I would guess they became experts on the celestial sky.
Oh, definitely, especially out here in the Southwest where the skies are very pristine, clear, you can see for miles, and the stars at night just come out at you, and you can I enjoy going out on my deck every night and watching the stars, and you know, they had a lot to do during the day because they
had to survive.
They had to survive. They had corn to grow. The Hopi are corn growers. They grew corn, beans, and squash in order to survive, and you know, they did dry farming. They had no irrigation, so they relied on the rains that fell and the weather, spiritual help definitely was part of their worldview.
And I bet they didn't get much rain in the Southwest, did they?
Well, the Southwest has a very limited rainfall. It depends on where you're at. Sometimes in the mountains you get more, but in the deserts you get, you know, 10 inches or less. It all seems to come in the summertime. We have the monsoons here in Arizona, and they start about July, and they run for a month or two, and we get a lot of rain in that period. But there's a whole ceremonial cycle that's geared around the weather, geared around the rainfall, and this involves various spirits that the Hopi were connected with.
Do you get much flooding when it rains that hard?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of flooding. The desert just you can see it real fast. And, you know, a lot of people try to drive through these washes, these dry washes that fill up real fast, and they get stuck in the middle, and they have to rely on helicopters to get them out of there.
You have written a number of books, Gary. There's a theme there around the Arizona-Orion correlation. What is that?
Yes. I have lived here, as I said, for 18 years, and I started going to some Kachina dances. The Kachinas, some of your listeners might know about Kachinas. They are the Hopi spirits. They're kind of like angels or messengers. Mm-hmm. They're intermediaries between the world of men and the world of the gods. And some of your listeners might know the recognize the Kachina dolls that the Hopi carve. The Kachina dolls were originally for just for the children, so they could learn what these different spirits looked like. There are so many different types of Kachinas. One for every force in the universe, really. They have masks. They have these very colorful masks that they wear. And the masks are multiform. They're circular. They can be dome-shaped. They can be cylindrical. Some of the masks have horns or feathers, and there's hair sticking out of some of them. And some of the eyes are bug-eyed, and others have slits for eyes.
Was this the Hopi's vivid imagination, or did they witness these things?
I think they really witnessed these creatures. The Hopi say that these creatures used to come in the flesh. They used to be physical beings that came down, some from the skies even, on various craft, and we can talk about that a little bit. But they came in the flesh, but now because of the corrupted ways of humankind, they only come in the spirit. Okay? And the Hopi perform these dances to honor these Kachinas. The Kachinas come to the Hopi mesas in the spirit world, in spirit, and they stay with the Hopi, and they are benevolent spirit beings. So they help the Hopi with agriculture and the rainfall, and the Hopi perform these dances in the village plazas. It's an amazing thing to watch a Kachina dance. Because you have a solitary drummer drumming in the plaza, and you have these Kachinas, a line of Kachinas, walking around and around the plaza for hours on end in the hot desert sun. And like I say, they have these different sorts of masks, and it's so bizarre to see these otherworldly creatures dancing in the village plaza. They're dancing for rain and fertility, and basically to help the Hopi people survive in this very harsh environment.
Tell us about the Hopi specifically, Gary, and how advanced were they compared to other Native American tribes throughout the country?
Well, the Hopi are basically agrarian people. They're farmers. They grew corn. They lived in stone apartment buildings called pueblos, and they built these pueblos at various sites around the American Southwest. They, unlike the Lakota Sioux, for instance, they were sedentary. They weren't nomadic. They didn't get around too much after they basically settled on the mesas where they live now. Their life is taken up by farming. A lot of their ritual is involved in farming and agriculture and rainfall, and just to survive out there in the desert. They have to do this. They have to rely on the Creator in order to survive.
And they were very, very into prophecy, weren't they?
Yeah, the Hopi have what I call a legacy of prophecy. And we could get into that a little later if you want. But, you know, there's so many prophecies that are coming true in these times that we're told for hundreds or thousands of years, these prophecies were passed down from mouth to mouth. From father to son, from father to children, and they said what would happen at the end of the fourth world. Many Hopi elders that I've talked to say that we are living right at the end of the fourth world. There's been three previous worlds, and we're at this end of the fourth world.
How many left?
Well, the Hopi say that there are nine altogether, nine worlds. But We are soon to pass into the fifth world. It's like the Maya, the Hopi have this idea of cyclic time. I like to say that the Hopi are masters of space, whereas the Maya are masters of time. The Maya were obsessed with time and calendars calculating time into the millions of years. But the Hopi, they are not concerned with certain dates like December 21st, 2012. When you ask a Hopi when he thinks the fourth world will end, he probably says something like, well, maybe in my lifetime or soon. He also usually gives a vague answer to this question.
With the Hopi, and we're going to get into a lot of their belief systems and their prophecies as well, but were they particularly concerned about anything, Gary? I mean, were they happy people, or were they always on edge?
Well, I think they were basically happy. They did their ceremonies. Their life revolved around their ceremonial cycle, and they're raising the corn. And I think they were basically a happy people until the modern times, when various modern pressures of earning a living, and they can't live the way they used to live in many cases. It's kind of a mixed bag on the Hopi mesas. I should mention that the Hopi live on three primary mesas in northern Arizona.
And how many are still around?
Well, there are about 7,000 Hopis.
That's it?
That's it, yeah. Uh-huh. The Navajo Nation, or the Diné, as they like to call themselves, are a much larger tribe. They surround the Hopi Reservation. And the Navajo Reservation runs into New Mexico, so it's a huge reservation, but it surrounds the smaller Hopi Reservation, and there's always been kind of an animosity between the Hopi and the Navajo. Maybe that's too strong a word. Maybe just a kind of a tension between the two tribes. Navajo word Anasazi, which is the ancient word for the Hopi, means ancient enemy. Okay, so they've always been kind of the Navajo moved down into the area, and the Hopi were already living in Arizona. The Navajo archaeologists say moved down into this area about 1600 AD.
Were they particularly advanced, the Hopi, or just primarily spiritual?
There's different types of spirituality. I think the Navajo are very spiritual people as well, and they have their own ceremonies, but their language is different, their traditions are different. And again, they were a migratory people, the Navajo, whereas the Hopi tended to stay in one place. That is, after the Great Migration Period, where the Hopi did indeed travel around the Southwest and building pueblos. They build a pueblo and live there for maybe 100 years or 200 years, and then they'd suddenly abandoned the pueblo and moved to another space, another spot.
Why'd they leave?
Well, I think there's a lot of theories about why they left. Maybe it has to do with drought in the certain times, and they wanted to move to an area with more water. But I really think that basically they wanted to follow the dictates of a god called Masau. And we can get into Masau because he's a really interesting Hopi god. The Masau kind of directed the migration period for the Hopi and told them where to go and where to build their pueblos. And a very influential god.
Was this god somewhat like Jesus? Did they describe him like that?
He is considered a creator by some, but he is such a complex figure. He's also the god of the underworld, the god of death, and the god of this earth plane. And he's sort of related to or analogous to Osiris in Egypt. He's a resurrection god. And physically, Masao is a very spooky-looking character. He wears a mask, usually, with large round eyes.
Sounds like he might have been an E.T.
Well, that's, very, very close. You can go to my website, theorionzone.com, and there's a picture right at the top of the page of what this god Masao looks like. He has a round mouth, and his head is bald, and he sort of resembles a summer squash in the texture and the shape of his head. And his feet are very long, and his body is gray.
Oh, man, he sounds like an extraterrestrial.
His body is gray, and the word Masao, M-A-S is the root word, and that literally means gray. And he really looks from pictures that artists have drawn of this god, using Hopi descriptions.
Well, clearly he didn't look like the Hopis, right?
No, he didn't at all look like the Hopis. He didn't look human at all. He looked like an extraterrestrial gray. You know,
is that why they named him a god?
Well, I think so. He was one of the original gods of the Hopi. When the Hopi came up out of the Grand Canyon, and we can talk about that, they emerged from the previous world into the fourth world, the current fourth world. And Masao was waiting for them. And Masao had a digging stick and a sack of seeds. And he said, well, if you want to live here in this desert and live a simple life, I'll teach you how to survive here. So he taught the Hopi how to survive in this very harsh region. Physically, he's a very frightening god. He's a nocturnal god. He's the only nocturnal god in the Hopi pantheon. All the rest of them come out during the daytime. But Masao comes out at night, and sometimes you see Masao in the form of fireballs dancing across the mesas. That's one of the signs of Masao. Masao is close by. And, you know, I've talked to some Hopi about Masao, and some Hopi will not say anything about this god because it's almost taboo, because he's so frightening. He's the god of death. But other Hopis, depending on their certain clan, there are various clans in the Hopi, like the Fire Clan, takes this god as its tutelary god. So they're more willing to talk about Masao and discuss what this god is.
Tell me about the title of your book that we're talking about tonight, Star Shines and Earth Works.
Yeah, Star Shines and Earth Works. I've written, this is my fourth book, Star Shrines. Basically, the Star Shrines are these cities, these pueblos across the Southwest that are in a pattern of various constellations, particularly Orion, okay? I started to talk about, you know, going up to the Hopi Mesas and watching these Kachina dances. And I had just read Robert Bouval's book, The Orion Mystery.
Sure, great
and,
book.
Yeah, and it talks about the Orion's Belt mirroring the three pyramids on the Giza Plateau. And I was driving up towards the Hopi Mesas to go to a Kachina dance. And I was gazing up to the three mesas where the Hopi lives, and I thought, well, maybe there's an Orion correlation right here in Arizona.
Hold on for a second, Gary. We're going to come right back with you on Coast to Coast AM. Well, on Wednesdays, we sound off. We have a Coast to Coast listener who tells us how they feel, and boy, do they. You can sound off, too. Send us your editorial with your phone number to editorial@coasttocoastam.com, and you may be on the program just like this.
This is Lynn from Lafayette, and this is my sound off. Endless predictions of end times are baseless. They work from the premise we are in end time. However, the New Testament clearly shows the end time was the end of the generation of the apostles in the first century. This dominant theme is doctrine. It is not popular and therefore ignored. All references to the end time in the New Testament show impending warnings to the disciples only in the first century. They don't apply to us today. So why do we only look at ourselves today rather than the lives of the disciples in the New Testament? This is Lynn from Lafayette, and this has been my sound off.
And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Gary David with us, and of course, we're talking about his work, Star Shines and Earth Works, and you were right in the middle of telling us a little bit about this and how you came up with the title, Gary. Go ahead, I'll let you finish that part of it.
Sure. My books all deal in one way or another with this Orion correlation in Arizona. And like I said, I was driving up from the south towards the Hopi Mesas. And the Hopi have lived on the mesas since about 1100 AD is when they settled in there. And they've lived there ever since. And I was wondering, well, you know, could there be an Orion correlation here in Arizona? And I put that at the back of my mind and went up and watched the Kachinas dance. And then I came back home and I got out my sky chart and I got out my map and compared the two. And George, what they were amazingly similar. The Orion correlation was amazingly similar in both the terrestrial and the celestial. There was a pattern on the Earth of the Orion constellation very clearly, and the angles were almost the same. Clearly, the pattern of villages that the Hopi had built wanted to reflect this constellation that they thought was the most important constellation in their ceremonial cycle.
You know, Gary, as you got into all of this, was there anything that startled you that you found to be just unbelievably strange?
Well, just the Hopi culture is the most spiritual culture that I've ever run into. I've studied the Lakota Sioux in South Dakota, and they have an amazing ritual called the Sun Dance. And, you know, Richard Harris had a movie some time ago that depicted the Sun Dance with a rather brutal piercing of the skin and dancing around a central tree. But the Hopi, the complexity of their religion is simply baffling, and it's almost inscrutable to an outsider. You really have to be an insider to really scratch. You can just scratch the surface with the Hopi. They have a lot of different clans and a lot of different rituals that they perform throughout the year. And it's a very complex society, and they spend most of their energy to keep this ritual cycle going. I mean, it's very difficult, especially in these times when they have to, you know, some of the Hopi have to get jobs in Flagstaff and Phoenix and, you know, try to live in two worlds at once. And that's basically the reservation life in these times. But the Hopi spend a tremendous amount of energy keeping this cycle going.
Well, there's no doubt about that. Gary, what are the Hopi flying shields? What is that?
The flying shields are basically flying saucers. They have many myths about these flying shields. They call them Pa Tu Vota, and the word Pa means water or wonder, and the word Tu Vota means shield. So they're a wonder shield, or, you know, water is wonder in the desert, of course. But perhaps these shields looked like concentric rings in a pool of water. That's the image that I come up with. And they talk about these flying shields coming down. They were piloted by these Kachinas that I mentioned before. Sometimes they were piloted by a sky god named Sotuknang. Sotuknang is a very important god, just like Masau. There's a really kind of an endearing story about Sotuknang and when he came down to Earth. It was a time when there was a huge flood, and it was engulfing the village, and the people were fleeing the village. They had to get out of the village. And there were these two children, they were twins, a boy and a girl, and they were kind of missed in the chaos, and the parents and everybody else left. And they had to set out on their own across the desert to try to find out where the parents had gone. And they camped the first night, and they saw a huge star in the sky, and the star got bigger and bigger and bigger. And finally, the star set down on the earth, and this creature got out of the craft. And the creature was described very specifically. The children said that his face shone like a star, and like his clothing glittered like icicles. So you know, you get the image that there, it was a metallic kind of costume or clothing that this creature wore, this god Sotuknang that they called him. And this god took these children up into this craft, and they went above the earth, and this was a benevolent god, so he gave the children something to eat, some melons and some corn to eat, and he said, don't be afraid. I will come to you in your dreams to tell you how to live, the proper way to live. And then the god directed the craft to where the parents had gone, mm-hmm. and the craft was set down right next to where the parents were camping, and the children got out, and Sotuknang said, you know, I will return again in your dreams to show you the proper path to live.
Well, that's fascinating that it echoes a lot of other civilizations, doesn't it?
Sure, yeah. You know, the Hopi women honor these flying shields by weaving grass and reed, round grass and reed shaped with a star in the middle. To kind of look like these flying shields. It's a traditional craft that they use. And, you know, I've seen petroglyphs that depict a triangular-shaped, look like flying craft. So, you know, it's very much a part of Hopi legend and Hopi myth, Hopi mythology. There are some of the Kachinas also pilot these flying shields, and there are tales that that talk about the Kachinas coming down and taking a Hopi bride. So the Kachinas are mating with Hopi women. There are tales of these Kachinas mating with Hopi women and taking brides. And this is kind of like the watchers, the sons of God. Coming down and mating with the daughters of men in the book of Genesis. It's a very similar scenario.
I was going to say, it's very biblical, isn't it?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Gary, in your opinion, what do you think has happened here with the Hopis? What do you think they experienced?
Well, I think they actually experienced these physical creatures coming down, the Kachinas, these spirit messengers, these angelic beings that were actually physical beings to start with. Now, as I said, they only come in the spirit. But the Hopi, they have many myths about all these bizarre creatures like Masau and Sotuknang and all these Kachinas. They must have had some kind of actual It wasn't fancy. It wasn't just making things up. It was an actual encounter with the spiritual dimension. Or maybe these creatures are interdimensional, and they come to the Hopi that way.
Tell me a little bit about the ant people and the Hopi legend here.
Well, the ant people are very interesting group. Really, the Hopi would not have survived without the ant people. The Hopi have lived in three different worlds before this current world. The first world was destroyed by fire, some kind of asteroid strike or volcanism. The second world was destroyed by ice, maybe a great ice age. And during these two world cataclysms, the ant people took the Hopi down into caverns in the Grand Canyon. And they showed the Hopi how to sprout beans. Now, beans are one of the main sources of food for the Hopi.
It's a staple for them, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, corn, beans, and squash. Yeah, but the beans are sprouted in these caves, in these caverns. And today they sprout these beans in a kiva, which is an underground prayer chamber.
Well, did they call these people ant people because they looked like ants or because they lived underground?
Well, I think they did look like ants. Because I've seen petroglyphs of these ant people, and they have kind of antenna and big eyes like ants, and they look like ants. You know, the rock art that I've seen in the Southwest, they look like the ants. They actually do, and it's kind of funny that the word for ant in Hopi is Anu, and the word for friend is Naki. So you put the two together, the Anunnaki.
Perfect.
You know, they have these spindly bodies and large eyes, and, you know, they're very insectoid-looking. But they actually saved the Hopi from two world destructions, the destruction of the first world and the destruction of the second world.
Yeah, well, how do they do that?
Well, they brought them down into caverns, and, you know, this was going on by the first world by fire. They escaped the fire that way by going underground.
I mean, how do we know they didn't bring them down there to try to eat them or something? You know?
Well, the Hopi say that these are, again, they're not malevolent creatures. They're there to help the Hopi. You know, the Hopi have always said that the ant people help them survive. They didn't, you know, try to harm them in any way.
Hmm. Well, what happened to them?
Well, the ant people apparently are still around. There's talk of ant people here and there. I get the rumors of still activity involving ant people, but they're still with the Hopi. And they're still helping them.
These creatures, I mean, you were mentioning, of course, the Hopi god, Misau, who looked like an alien gray. We've got these ant people. Tell me about the story of the Mothman down there, because there seems to be a correlation between all these things.
Yeah, the Mothman, it's at a very specific place. It's the Mothman lived at a place called Pottery Mound in New Mexico. And it's just kind of by the city of Los Lunas, New Mexico. And a pueblo was built in the 13th century on top of a pyramid. It was a flat-top pyramid, and they put a pueblo on top of it. And the people built a number of rectangular kivas. A kiva, again, is an underground subterranean prayer chamber with a hole or hatchway in the roof. And these rectangular walls allowed for murals of different things. Now, some of the murals, they're very colorful. They're brightly colored. But they look like the typical Mothman that was seen in the 19th
John Keel's book.
Yeah. And you see, archaeologists have actually, you know, preserved these murals and reproduced them. And you can see, and they have wings, and they have, you know, a proboscis, a coiled proboscis, like a moth. And the people actually, you know, they were half human and half moth. They look just like the Mothman that we're familiar with from John Keel's book.
And these ant people, you say, are still down there?
The ant people, I think they're still in the Grand Canyon, in caverns, and in various places around the Southwest. I need to do some more investigation, because I've heard rumors of an ant people in a certain place in New Mexico that I need to investigate. But, you know, the investigation still is ongoing.
Has anybody been hurt?
Oh, no. The ant people are basically good people, or good creatures, I should say.
Whatever they are.
Yeah. But I wanted to mention, though, the Mothman. And the fact that also archaeologists found at this one place, Pottery Mound, they found Datura seeds, which Datura is a hallucinogen, a powerful psychedelic. And it's a rather dangerous psychedelic, too. So I would not advise experimenting with this plant. It's called Jimson weed as well. And
good way to get killed.
Oh, yeah. In fact, Andrew Weil, the ethnopharmacologist, and now he's a health guru, he says this is a very bad drug to try to experiment with. But they found seeds and pods at this one site, and to prove that these people living at Pottery Mound were using this particular drug or this plant, Jimson weed, and performing ceremonies.
The Hopi you're talking
about?
Well,
the ancestors of the Hopi. The ancestors of the Hopi. The Hopi call them Hizatsinome, or simply the ancient ones. That's the term they call their ancestors. There was a term Anasazi that used to be used, but now it's kind of fallen out of favor.
How so?
Well, the Anasazi is basically a Navajo word that means ancient enemy, and the Hopi don't like to use Navajo words to describe their ancestors, so they use their own language, Hizatsinome, to describe the ancient ones.
Tell me a little bit about the Lost City in the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, the Lost City is, George, I get more questions about the Lost City than any other subject.
Really? How come?
Well, people just are fascinated by this story. Now, whether it's true or not, I'm not sure. But here are the bare bones of the story.
Well, I tell you what, we're almost at the top of the hour. Let's come right back and we'll talk about that. Where do we get your book, by the way?
You can get my book at theorionzone.com. Or Adventures Unlimited Press, or at Amazon, or Barnes & Noble.
Okay, it's all over the place. Super.
Yeah.
We'll come back. More to talk with you about this. Coast to Coast AM.